Radio Prague News.
The Czech Lower House has approved the EU association agreement with Ukraine. The Prime Minister has said that the Social Democrats will not field a presidential candidate at all costs in 2018. And the army and police are to take part in a one-day training exercise to secure the country's borders. Members of the Czech Lower House of Parliament approved an EU association agreement with Ukraine after several hours of rowdy debate on Thursday night. The final vote was 107 in favor, with 29 against. Most of those opposed to the agreement came from the Communist Party. Social Democrat members of Parliament, though, also criticized the stance of Ukrainian nationalists and the continuing influence of oligarchs in Ukraine. The Czech Republic is one of the last four EU states to ratify the agreement. The Upper House of Parliament, the Senate, did so already in November of last year. The Czech head of state will still have to give his approval to the final agreement. The Social Democrats' Prime Minister Bohuslav Sobotka has made clear will not field a party candidate at all costs in the 2018 presidential elections. He made the statement in an interview for the financial daily Hospodarské noviny, suggesting a party referendum could decide which course to take. In the view of the financial daily, a decision by the Social Democrats not to field their own candidate would markedly help President Miloš Zeman's chances for re-election if he runs. The daily notes that communication between Mr. Sobotka and the president has improved in recent months. Several hundred members of the Czech military and police forces will take part in a one-day training exercise at the end of September to secure the borders of the Czech Republic. The mock scenario will test command and personnel readiness in the event of a marked worsening of conditions, in other words, a jump in the number of illegal migrants heading for the country. So far, the Czech Republic has served largely as a transit country for refugees heading to neighboring Germany and other parts of Central or Western Europe. One of seven people brutally attacked on Wednesday when unknown assailants held up a family business in the area of Tábor has died from his injuries. According to available information, three people were seriously injured, two of them critically, in the incident. The police did not confirm the exact number of attackers at the firm, nor weapons used, but it is thought that those hurt were beaten with metal rods. Turning to sport now, and specifically football, on Thursday, Czech football teams made a mixed start in their initial group games in the Europa League. Viktoria Plzeň won 2-0 against Dynamo Minsk, but Sparta Prague earned a tough 1-1 draw away at Greek side Asteras Tripolis. And Slovan Liberec lost 0-1 at home against Portuguese team Braga. And staying with football, goalkeeper Petr Cech will face former club Chelsea for the second time since moving to cross-London club Arsenal, but in their first regular season match. Arsenal are currently in fourth place in the team standings, while the league champions began the season poorly and are 17th. At the beginning of August, Cech helped the Gunners defeat Chelsea 1-0 in the Community Shield at Wembley Stadium. I'm Jan Vellinger. You'll find more news at radio.cz.
You are listening to Radio Prague, the international service of Czech radio, with me, Lud Franková. Coming up in today's program, the long-delayed Blanka Tunnel complex finally opens to traffic. We have the roundup of this week's business news. And later on in the program, the renowned British philosopher Roger Scruton records teaching at underground seminars in communist Czechoslovakia in the 1980s. All that coming up, so please stay with us. The newly constructed Blanka Tunnel complex will open to traffic on Saturday on the 19th of September. The longest city tunnel in Europe was to have been the pride of Prague, but it has been dogged by problems, opening 4 years late and way over budget. Daniela Lazarová has more.
The Blanka Tunnel Complex, the city's costliest ever project, will connect the area west of Prague Castle with Troyer District in the northeast. The complex of three tunnels, almost 6 kilometres long with several multi-level road junctions, was designed to link up with a Prague city ring road and is intended to relieve the historic city centre of heavy traffic. It should also give drivers a smoother passage through the city, saving them an estimated 15 minutes. Although a major construction project of this kind could have been expected to run into some problems, the complications accompanying the Blanka Tunnel complex exceeded all expectations. Its planned opening in 2011 was repeatedly postponed, and its cost ballooned from a projected 17.8 billion crowns to 43 billion. At one point, Metrostaff, the company building it, stopped work on the tunnel for several months, claiming Prague City Hall was not paying its bills, an argument which had to be settled by an arbitration court. And in December of last year, the current mayor of Prague, Adriana Krnáčová, reacted with anger to yet another delay, telling the media that the project had been designed by idiots when it emerged that several kilometres of newly installed electric cables had been damaged by rainwater and had to be replaced. In the end, to avoid further embarrassment, all sides agreed to hold their peace until the tunnel had been completed. The tunnel complex is now ready to open to traffic and successfully passed a series of final safety tests on Thursday. However, the delays and arguments accompanying it have thrown a damper on its opening. Instead of a fanfare celebration and a launch by a Formula One car, Prague City Hall has announced a simple ribbon-cutting ceremony. The Prague councillor in charge of infrastructure, Petr Dolínek, said anything else would have been a farce. And President Miloš Zeman long ago made it clear that he would not be attending Blanka's opening, saying that the project well reflected the secondary meaning of the word tunnel.
Daniela Lazarová with that report. But now I'm joined in the studio by Ian Willoughby for the summary of this week's business news.
The Czech Republic's foreign debt grew by 137 billion crowns year on year to 2.9 trillion crowns in the second quarter of this year, amounting to 66.4% of gross domestic product, the Czech National Bank said on Friday. The foreign liabilities of the government sector accounted for 21.3% of the total external debt, while the banking sector is responsible for 29.4%. The external liabilities of the corporate sector accounted for the remaining 49.3%.
This year's Czech hop harvest is likely to be the worst in the past 45 years, the Hop Growers Association announced this week. According to preliminary results, the yield of hops this year dropped by 35% compared to 2014 to 4,100 tons of hops. Czech hop growers expect a slump in profit amounting up to 350 million crowns, the chairman of the Hop Growers Association, Luboš Hejda, said. This year's crops were damaged by very high temperatures and droughts. Dry weather has also caused hops to have a lesser concentration of alpha acids, which are responsible for the bitter flavour in beer.
Czech firms associated in the Confederation of the Czech Aviation Industry have this year increased their turnover by 15% compared to the previous year to 11.9 billion crowns, the association's representatives said this week. Last year's export amounted to 10.5 billion crowns. Thanks to a growing number of commissions last year, the number of employees in the Czech aviation industry increased by 14%. However, firms are complaining of a lack of people with adequate technical qualifications.
The Czech Republic has the highest number of breweries per head among EU countries. According to data released this week by the European Association of Breweries, there is one brewery for 31,000 people in the Czech Republic. Denmark placed second with one for every 37,000 people, followed by Austria, Lithuania and Great Britain. The Czech Republic moved to first position from last year's third place. According to the monthly Pivo, Beer and Ale, there are currently 336 breweries in the Czech Republic.
The Odeon Financial Group, which owns the Cedoc Travel Agency in the Czech Republic, has acquired a luxury hotel complex in Croatia's Split from the Austrian state company Heta Asset Resolution. The marketing head of Cedok, Tomáš Brecha, announced this week. The transaction reportedly amounted to billions of crowns. Grand Hotel Lav is the biggest five-star hotel in Croatia. It has over 380 rooms, 800 metres of beaches and promenades, a private marina, and one of the country's largest conference facilities. According to Mr. Brecha, the hotel will also be available to Cedok clients.
Just a reminder that you are listening to Radio Prague, the international service of Czech radio. Coming up next, Roger Scruton has long been regarded as one of the UK's leading conservative thinkers. He also has very close connections to the Czech Republic, as Ian Willoughby found out when he interviewed the philosopher this week.
The British philosopher Roger Scruton began giving underground seminars at the homes of Czechoslovak dissidents in the late 1970s. He was eventually thrown out of the communist state, but the clandestine network he contributed to remained in place until the Velvet Revolution, when several of its graduates helped shape the new democracy. This week, Scruton was back in Prague for the Forum 2000 conference, and it was there that I asked the renowned conservative thinker what his recollections were of his first visit to the city.
I came from Poland, and in 1979, Poland was kind of fermenting because of the election of the Pope of the Karol Wojtyła to the throne of St. Peter. So there was the Polish Pope. There's this revival of religious feeling, a sense in Poland that something was changing. The ground was beginning to tremble. And so coming from there, I came as though already animated by the sense that something might change. But of course, the immediate effect, stepping off the train from Krakow in the main train station here, was of total silence. You know, that was the thing that most impressed me. Everywhere was silent. If you went to a bar or a restaurant, people could mumble or whisper, but there was no real noise. The noise of human life had been extinguished.
You came here to give these underground seminars.
Yeah.
How did they come about?
Well, the underground seminars, they had been operating in this city since quite early on, I think since the 60s, Jan Patočka had always had seminars for his students, and when he was thrown out of the university, he continued home, you know, domestic seminars. People at Václav Havel used to go to them. That was the older generation, but they weren't opened to the general public because of the risks involved. But then Julius Tomin, who was himself not really fully part of a university anyway, but had acquired an interest in classical philosophy, he set up his own seminar and opened it to people and tried to get in touch with people in the West. For the most part, his pleas for help were ignored, but one of them was picked up by Cathy Wilkes, my colleague in Oxford, and she decided, OK, I'm going to go and see this guy, see whether there's something we shouldn't be doing. And she came back fired up and said, you know, said to herself, I'm going to get my colleagues to go and give lectures and see if this doesn't make a difference. And so we all were recruited by this passionate woman who wouldn't accept no for an answer. And so we all went.
How did it work in practical terms? Was there a lot of cloak and dagger stuff?
It wasn't cloak and dagger, but you had to be careful. You couldn't take a message written down from somebody to somebody else. You had to be careful where you stayed, whom you talked to. In my first experience was one of being obstructed by the police, who were keeping vigil over Tomin's apartment. So I was actually manhandled by them, but I did eventually manage to get past them and give my talk. And then I got to know especially the young people there, and I was very touched by their situation. And so what happened was, we back in England, we all got together and said, well, you know, what should we do about this? We set up a proper network underground, very carefully and patiently over many years, so that it wouldn't be easy to disrupt it.
Did many of the Czech dissidents share your conservative outlook, or were they kind of shaped by the communist environment, even if they were opposed to communism?
Let's put it this way, the Jan Hus Trust that we set up and the underground university that we we organized was not a political organization. It was conceived in the model, the traditional model of British education, that there might be a possible difference of opinion. Of course, I'm a well-known conservative, but I didn't do any teaching of that, perhaps I might have once or twice explained to people what conservatism is, but my main interest was in teaching them philosophy. It is true that people here were intrigued by what it is to be a conservative, because it was not a tradition that they had, and certainly not a tradition of calling yourself that, and that's a very English or Anglo-American thing. But of course, they immediately recognized when I explained it to them that it was possible to have a non-socialist view of the world. Most of them already had a non-socialist view of the world.
I read a quote from you that Havel never agreed with anything that I wrote or said. What particular issues did you clash over?
Did I say that? I guess, I mean, he was a social democrat who believed in the role of the state as a humanizing force, as something that would set an example and also guide society to a more just and equal future. So he'd retained those old social democrat ideas, and about that I disagreed with him, I suspect, because I'm very much, I see the necessity for the state, but I'm much more interested in building civil society as something independent of the state. Interestingly enough, that's exactly what Havel himself was doing. And when he ascended to the castle, it wasn't really as part of the state. It was as though the civil society had come out on top.
Getting back to the underground seminars, how did it work in terms of language? Philosophical language is difficult, and I guess a lot of those guys of that generation wouldn't have had great English.
Yes, that was a great problem, the language. But we did, you know, people worked hard. We sent in literature in advance in English or German, because people were quite fluent in German. And in the seminars, someone would translate for us. And after a while, this language difficulty became much less urgent because people had picked up the technicalities. And the broad range of interests meant that people learnt to improvise around each other's way of looking at things.
How did your underground teaching here come to an end?
Well, my experience came to an end in 1985 when I was arrested in Brno and thrown out. I knew that I was going to be arrested. I just had one or two further things to do, some people to meet, and it didn't matter that I was arrested because we'd got things so well set up by then that we could communicate with all our friends without trouble.
After 1989, some of your former students entered public life, entered politics. I guess you must have watched their progress with interest.
Yes, I know. It was wonderful to see that, you know, we didn't expect 1989. At least I didn't. I thought we've got a plan for communism going on forever. But we had a duty to teach what we could. But, of course, after 1989, immediately people from our network, Havel, of course, was always in contact with us, but Pittard, Czarnogórski, they were major parts of our network. They were immediately in high office. Rummel, who became Home Minister, and Jerzy Schneider, who did a degree through us underground. Milan Ude was one of our, who was Minister of Culture. But lots of ministers came out of the network that we had created, and with the kind of inspiration that we had helped them to acquire.
Do you follow Czech politics still? And if you do, what are your impressions?
It's a depressing thing to follow Czech politics because when you think you've understood it, the next day everything has changed all over again. One thing you can be certain of, though, is that whoever is president and whoever is prime minister, they don't get on. The power networks are very corrupt, obviously, but also power is much more important for them than any serious conception of the nation's future. Now, that has been very depressing.
After all these decades spent with Czech people, how would you characterize Czechs as a nation, if you could?
The Czechs are very close to us English in some respects. That is, they are ironical, even cynical, self-deprecating. They're not easy to deceive, but they are also, and they seem cold on the surface, but they also have this quite sturdy instinct for their own country and for their home. You know, they are not people who are going to allow things to be taken away from them easily. I relate to them very easily, partly because of the mutual irony, but also because of their respect for culture. They think it matters to know things, it matters to have read things, matters to like the right things in art and music and so on. And that is rare in modern Europe, and it distinguishes the Czechs from the Germans.
As a philosopher of aesthetics, how do you view the way Prague has changed over the decades?
Well, I'm instinctively hostile to modernist ways of building. And unfortunately, the new towers scattered around Prague are of the worst kind. I mean, they're simply horizontal slabs built one on top of each other. And I think most Czechs think that too. I've never heard anybody in Prague praise these developments. But on the other hand, the Czechs have really tried to tidy up their city, and they do take pride in it. And they are a very aesthetic nation, and perhaps architecture is one of their great achievements. Why does everybody come to Prague? It's because it's one of the architectural jewels of European civilization. And that wasn't done without the Czechs themselves being part of it.
Tell us about your book, Notes from the Underground, which has just come out in Czech.
Looking back over my experiences in the 1980s, it all came together at a certain point, very recently in my mind, in the form of a love story set in the underground university and among young people who had been deprived of all opportunities. And, of course, love was a very important thing in those circumstances because it was the one aspect of human life in which you were prepared to make a sacrifice, because in every other aspect, sacrifice was just too costly. So I took the story of two people who were prepared to make sacrifices, but unfortunately their sacrifices don't coincide. So I used it to evoke the atmosphere of those days.
Did you run it by any Czech friends for authenticity?
Of course, yes. I obviously tried it out on one or two Czech friends. One of them wrote to me saying, you know, reading your book was like coming home, which was, I think, the nicest thing that could be said.
Philosopher Roger Scruton talking there to my colleague Ian Willoughby. And I'm afraid that's all we have time for in today's programme. If you have any comments about today's programme, then please send them to us. You can contact us by email at english@radio.cz or on Facebook and Twitter. We'll be glad to hear from you. But that's all for now from me, Ruth Franková. Thank you very much for joining us, and goodbye.